Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning.
Dear Mr. President, we honor you today, sir. Each of us brought you our tax dollars. It takes a lot of Benjamins to run a campaign. We paid our dues. Where's our change? We'll vote for you in 2012. Is that true? Look at the Republicans. What are we to do? Even though we don't know if we'll retain our liberties in what you seem content to call a free society. Yes, it's true that Terry Jones is legally free to burn a people's holy book in shameful effigy. But at another location in this country, alone in a 6x12, cell sits Bradley. 23 hours a day is night. The Fifth and Eighth Amendments say this kind of thing ain't right.
Nobel Peace Prize whistleblowers on the move. One to go, one Mendez, two process. There's an alumni for its tribe.
Fresh Juice Party, Where's Our Change? You can find out more about their music at freshjuiceparty.com. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. We are now streaming live on the Internet. You can go to kkrn.org and click on the Listen button to hear our streaming feed. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and underwriters like yourselves. If you'd like to donate and keep us on the air, you can go to kkrn.org once again and click on the Donate button to support our efforts. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. If you've got a comment or maybe you can even help educate other listeners by calling in and maybe sharing your knowledge with us. So don't hesitate to call 337-1885. You can also email me at unspun@kkrn.org. We also have a community calendar. I invite you to either write info@kkrn.org, and you can leave a little message there for Shane. And Shane puts together the community calendar, and then your event can go out over the air. Today's show is the second in an Unspun series entitled Truth About America. In the first of the series, we talked about the Declaration of Independence. That was last July the 5th, and appropriately enough, 4th of July weekend. And so we looked into who some of the founding fathers, who I call the founding patriarchs, who they were and what were the prevalent ideas of those times. What was the context of the Declaration of Independence in the colonies at that time? Today's show will take a closer look at the Revolutionary War, George Washington, and some of the realities of the people in the 13 colonies. My research for the show includes information readily available on the Internet. One particularly helpful website I found is historyisaweapon.com. Also the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and a lot of states have and towns have their own historical sites, too, that you can reference. There's all kinds of information on the Internet for you if you want to look into some of these things more. I also refer to Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States and also his other book, Voices of the People's History of the United States. The book that had a lot of information on some of our founding fathers like George Washington and Jefferson and Hamilton is Revolutionary Characters by Gordon Wood. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning author and journalist. Well, what is the truth about America? So let's take this opportunity to dig a little deeper on this show. We're going to call this show Truth About America Number 2, The American Revolutionary War, 1776 to 1785. Actually, the Revolutionary War started before that because the people in Boston and Massachusetts in general and New York City had already rebelled in 1774, 75. And the reaction of England, of Britain, the British Empire at that time, was to send more force, and that got more reactions, and it all kept escalating from there until the Declaration of Independence on July 4th, 1776. Once again, I want to invite you to call in, make comments. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885. And I know some of these things I'm going to say today are probably going to be considered maybe even blasphemy by some. But in honesty, it's just seeking the truth about who we are as Americans. So let's revisit something we talked about earlier in my first of the series about the Declaration of Independence. We took a close look at who the founding fathers were, the founding patriarchs. Who are they? Who were they? Well, they were smart, enlightened, which had a different meaning in those times, rich, white, elite landowners and slave owners, the great majority of whom had been working in colonial government under King George III of Britain. There were several that that publicly promoted monarchy even as the best form of government, even after the Revolutionary War. So rather than being in opposition to monarchy and that form of government, many of our founding fathers were actually in favor of that form of government because they really didn't trust the people. And besides that, they were elitists themselves. Many of them had relationships with the British government, with nobility, with the large landowners, Lord Baltimore, Lord Pitt, Lord Fairfax, all of these, they were lords, part of the British nobility, and they had holdings in America, and they were friends with many of the founding fathers. Let's take a little closer look at George Washington, because he is so exemplary, and a lot of the things that we think about George Washington and the famous scene of him going across the Delaware standing in a boat and the river full of ice and all the stories of Valley Forge and all that very noble and trying events during the war. But let's take a little closer look at who he was. He's considered the father of our country, the lead patriarch, if you want to put it in a different way. He was the richest American alive at his death. He inherited some of his land holdings, but he was not born a rich man. Many of you might say he must have been a resourceful, hardworking man. Well, no. He and his half-brother Lawrence moved in the right circles, British nobility in the colony of Virginia, named after the Virgin Queen of England, Victoria. Here's a quote from the Colonial Williamsburg Journal, which is in Virginia. And this is from their historical site and says, quote, George Washington's elder brother, Lawrence, an army officer, 14 years George's senior, and more a father figure than a brother, married into the Fairfax clan, one of Virginia's leading families, always a mover and a shaker and a canny social climber, Lawrence Washington understood that the path to influence and riches lay in cultivating connection with Virginia's colonial elite. George Washington joined the Masonic Lodge in Fredericksburg in 1752. In those days, it was a way to meet the right folks. By 1759, he married Martha Custis, a well-engineered top-drawer financial coup. the widow of a well-heeled gentleman planter. She was one of the wealthiest women in Virginia. She brought to the marriage prime Virginia acres whose worth today would measure in the millions of dollars. This bounty passed into her new husband's care, and Washington passed from being a comfortably well-off country gentleman soldier to become one of Virginia's wealthiest landowners. Election to the Virginia House of Burgesses was a natural progression, first from Frederick County and later as representative for Fairfax County. The Burgesses met in Williamsburg's Virginia capital. Now Washington was at the center of Virginia's elite, end quote. And just a note here, both George and his half-brother were career military officers in the British Army. The British Army, the army that eventually they would be fighting against, or not Lawrence, but George would be fighting against. So another note, for most of our history in England and America, women were not allowed to own land or have access to credit or have bank accounts in their name. So pretty handy to marry one of the richest women in Virginia at that time. Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun and the Experiment of Truth Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Today's show is titled Truth About America, Number 2. We are discussing our roots, the real history of the United States, and what it means to be an American. And we're focusing specifically on the Revolutionary War period, which some would say even started earlier than 1776, maybe 1774. We're talking about hold on a second. I got to shuffle my papers here. Yeah, we're talking about George Washington a little bit and who he was in reality. And he was actually quite an interesting person in many ways, besides being the father of our country. He was, of course, a military man. And everything that that meant in those days. So we're talking, and when he was a military man serving the British, he was fighting the Indians and the French for most of his career as a British Army officer. So he was very well acquainted with the western frontier of those days, which would be Pennsylvania and Ohio, the western part of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kentucky, all the Indian territories, which became the Indian territories, I should say. So George Washington's wealth and status in America, where did he fit into America? If we were to convert his wealth using percent of GDP, gross domestic product, and ranking among other peoples of a wealth today, he would be a multi-billionaire. And where would he rank amongst Americans today if he were ranked, say, by Fortune magazine? Well, he would rank somewhere a little below Warren Buffett and slightly higher than the Walmart heirs. So this is somebody worth billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. Even in today's, not in those days, they had, you know, was different money without inflation and, of course, the value of land and other measurements of wealth are not the same. But if he were alive today, owning what he owned, then he would be comparable to Warren Buffett, quite a bit below our little friend there at Microsoft, Bill Gates, but way up there in the rankings of rich people. And especially in his time. And most of his wealth was gotten through marriage, obviously married into it, which gave him the ability to do other things like speculate in land. And land speculation in an unhindered new republic that he was going to be the father of in the United States could be a very lucrative practice. So he also owned, traded, and rented human property, what we call today slaves, with over 316 slaves working the land and his land on his huge estate. He had a 7,000-acre Mount Vernon estate among his other land holdings. By the way, it was right across the Potomac from where today sits the Capitol, Washington, D.C., and he also chose the site of the Capitol. No doubt that did something to increase the value of his land in Virginia, if you think about it. In fact, where his property in Virginia now is where the Pentagon and all these huge agency, government agencies sit. So 316 slaves are working. They weren't all his slaves. He actually borrowed slaves from other slave owners. That's what I meant about renting them. And so that's who he was. He was an extremely rich landowner and military officer, which the military in those days, and even as it is today, is an elitist society. That's why you have officers and enlisted men are officers and draftees. The officers are usually tied in with the elite in society, and that's how they get their positions. We have a similar system today. In defense of George Washington, he was not the only founding patriarch to become rich speculating on stolen lands of Native American Indians. In fact, it was part of the plan from the beginning of the settling of America. The entire idea of the 13 colonies enacted by the British Empire was to exploit the natural resources of the New World. So this imperial aggression against the peoples in the New World, of course, that's a misnomer. It wasn't new to the Indians. They had been there for many thousands of years. And so, but it's funny how the nomenclature and the language we use seems to favor what we want to believe. It wasn't a new world. It was a world that had existed as long as any other rest of the part of the world. And it was one that the British Empire meant to exploit. And that meant seizing land from the Indian tribes and deeding it to British aristocracy. Most of the founding fathers were products of this aristocracy, and rule by a king or queen was all they had ever known. In fact, George Washington's friend and benefactor, Lord Halifax, was allowed to keep – or no, I think it was – that's wrong. Not Lord Halifax. I think it was Lord Fairfax. Is that right? Yeah, anyway, I don't think it was Halifax. He was allowed to keep his massive landholdings in Virginia even after the war, when most loyalists had either been burned out or thrown off their land and it was confiscated. But he got to keep his because he was a friend of George Washington, our great father of our country. And many of the loyalists during the war were not only murdered, their land was confiscated, some of it was burnt out. The Revolutionary War was not just a war against Britain. It was also a war against the frontier, which means more incursion in and control of the Indian tribes to the west of the Appalachians and north into the western part of New York State, where the Iroquois lived. And so we have a land where wealth was created through slave labor. And when we look at people like George Washington and the celebrated Democratic hero Thomas Jefferson, both of them gained their wealth through slave labor. And I just was thinking the other day that some of the Walmart heirs might have actually taken a lesson from George in the slave labor economy that we had back in the colonies and the early United States of America, because much of our wealth was on the backs of people that were captured and brought here against their will. And that's just the facts of slavery. The colonies were pretty much a class society, just much as the European countries that created them were. So there was always a rich elite that owned the land and those who worked for them. while in the cities, a growing middle class, working class was coming into their own. We hadn't really gotten to the Industrial Revolution yet. And so what we had is basically what today I remember George Bush's Secretary of Labor, I think her name was Chu. She was proudly, we call this a service economy. And well, a service economy is one where there's people with things and people without, and the people with are served by the people without. So this would be comparable to what we have in America. You know, gardeners are serving, you know, taking care of people that have money, their yards. The rich are served at the expense of everybody else. So this class society that that George Washington and all the founding fathers were a part of, they really didn't have they weren't closely associated with the poorer people and the working class. And let me read you this little excerpt from Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. The French and Indian War, quote, had brought glory for the generals, death to the privates, wealth for the merchants, unemployment for the poor. There were 25,000 people living in New York City when the French and Indian War ended. A newspaper editor wrote about the growing number of beggars and wandering poor in the streets of the city. Letters in the papers questioned the distribution of wealth. How often have our streets been covered with thousands of barrels a flour for trade, whilst our near neighbors can hardly procure enough to make a dumpling to satisfy their hunger. Gary Nash's study of city tax lists shows that by the early 1770s, the top 5% of Boston's taxpayers controlled 49% of the city's taxable assets. In Philadelphia and New York, too, wealth was more and more concentrated. In Boston, the lower classes began to use the town meetings to vent their grievances. The governor of Massachusetts had written that in these town meetings, the meanest inhabitants, by their constant attendance, generally are the majority and outvote the gentlemen, merchants, and substantial traders on all the better parts of the inhabitants. Kind of looking down his nose at the use of democracy in the town meetings. According to Zinn, starting with Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia, by 1760 there had been 18 uprisings aimed at overthrowing colonial governments. There had only been six black rebellions. There had also been six black rebellions from South Carolina to New York, and 40 riots of various origins. So let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Unspun, Experiment of Truth-Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Today's show is entitled Truth About America Number 2. We are discussing our roots, the real history of the United States, and what that means about who we are as Americans. Our caller number is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. So what was the situation? Well, we had a very unhappy populace. There was an elitist colonial government in place, still under King George. And out of that government, the founding fathers decided that, well, there's a lot of unrest. And how did that unrest come about? So let's look at what the historical situation was at that time. The British and the French had fought the French and Indian War up until just a decade before the signing of the Declaration of Independence, somewhere around 1766. Why is this important? Well, for a couple reasons. First, the war was fought over expansion of the colonies into the Ohio River Valley. Secondly, wars always have one thing in common. It's debt. England and France had incurred enormous debts in fighting this war, and in order to pay this debts, and guess who held the debt? Once again, it's the elite and the bankers of Europe and England. And so in order to pay that debt, Britain had to exploit the people in the colonies. They'd already exploited their own people, so now they had to exploit the people in the colonies because it was pretty much an untapped resource to them. And so they were going to try to do this in several ways. First of all, they had a continuing corporate monopolies. And also another method was raising taxes and putting tariffs on exports and imports. And by controlling trade and commerce, they could also determine which products Americans could buy, would buy from the British Empire, and which they would produce for the British Empire, and how much of a tariff was tacked onto those. So, which is the same methods we use today. We use the same ways of enslaving people and removing their wealth. As to the effects of these policies did start to weigh on the colonists after a while, because it was creating poor people. When you extract wealth, somebody has to pay, and that's usually the poorest and the hardest working people in a society, because they're much further down the food chain, and they have no force. They have no representation or force. They don't have their own armies and their own police forces. So those debts and that extraction of wealth from the colonies by the British Empire was accompanied by creating more poor people in the United States of America. And so this brought people to a point that was not acceptable. And so when one of the biggest things about the French and Indian War was the fact that it created this huge debt, in which required extraction of wealth from the colonies. And also the end of the French and Indian War theoretically ended the expansion. I say theoretically because we'll see later that it didn't end the expansion of the colonies to the West. The reason for this was the British, after defeating the French, they wanted to pacify the Indian tribes. They didn't want to be fighting on another front, and they'd already gone through a costly war. So they had made what was called the Proclamation of 1763, that proclamation made the lands west of the Appalachian Mountains out of bounds to white settlers. Once again, let me remind you, you're listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Today's show is entitled Truth About America, Number 2. We're discussing our roots, the real history of the United States during the period of the Revolutionary War, and what that means about who we are as Americans. Call in 337-1885, 337-1885. Well, as you can imagine, colonials who had, like George Washington, who had seen the Ohio River Valley in his campaign with the British Army, and most of the colonial land speculators and people that saw the potential of wealth in the land that was occupied by the Native American tribes, they were kind of disappointed in that. And so that, along with their own suffering, really set the stage for the Revolutionary War. The Revolutionary War itself was essentially, well, let me read you this. This is a quote from Wikipedia. Quote, "For the Americans, American Revolutionary War was essentially two parallel wars. While the war in the East was a struggle against British rule, the war in the West was an Indian war. The newly proclaimed United States competed with the British for control of the territory of Native American nations east of the Mississippi River and west of the Appalachian Mountains. The colonial interest in westward colonization, as opposed to the British policy of maintaining peace by designating areas reserved to Native Americans west of the Appalachians following the end of the Seven Years' War, was one cause of the revolution. Most Native Americans who joined in the struggle sided with the British as they hoped to win the opportunity to reduce settlement and expansion onto their lands. The Revolutionary War was the most extensive, and this is all a quote, and destructive Indian war in the United States history. So let me say here that I'm not saying that it didn't take bravery and loyalty and patriotism to go out and fight these wars. What I'm talking about here, other than those sacrifices that Americans have always made for the country, I'm talking about what were the motives of the leaders? Why were they really out there fighting? What were they fighting for? And who gained? You know, follow the money if you want to take that approach that we hear today is follow the money. Well, if you follow the money, it comes back to the elite and powerful colonists, the rich and powerful colonists at the time, our founding fathers. The interests, and you know, many historians point this out, that what were the real interests in wars, and in most wars, and many times in our past wars, usually special economic interests are at the bottom of these wars and the reason we go into them, even though that's not what we're told. It's never presented to the public in that way. Like Iraq, well, sure, we had weapons of mass destruction, and they were on our doorsteps. Why wait for that smoking gun to become the mushroom cloud? Scary, scary, scary stuff. And there are other methods that are used to attract people into the military. And many times, the people that are in the military are not there because they really want to be. They may be there for other reasons. During the Revolutionary War and even today, the same methods were used to either coerce or entice lower class people, and I mean that in the sense of working people and poorer farmers. And they were enticed to join into the service in the military. And one of those, well, there's several methods. Conscription, which we call the draft today, which is where somebody just says, "Well, you come and you serve in the military, and if you don't, well, we're going to come and drag you in, and then you'll be in the military anyway." And that's what happened during Vietnam. Also, what happened to the Civil War during the 1860s in America. Most of those people did not want to fight and kill their brothers or fellow Americans, but they were conscripted. They were drafted into that kind of service. And that was also an elitist process because almost immediately following the Declaration of Independence, those forefathers who were involved in that went back to their home states, which were still colonies at the time, and began recruiting and drafting young men into the military in preparation for the reaction from Great Britain. And but if you were rich, you didn't have to go. You could send one of your servants or one of your slaves or you could buy your way out. So, and today we sort of, that's what we call the poverty draft in today's terms. People that don't have other options and are, going to end up in the military one way or the other. That has always been a one way to get people that don't have money, that don't have wealth, into the military, is you draft them, but you allow the richer, more elitist to escape that draft. The other thing that was happening, and it was the same thing that the British was doing to the colonists, was something called impressment. And impressment was basically what we call today Shanghaiing people, where you go out and you just grab them and you drag them onto the ship and you sail, and now they're part of your crew. Other methods were promises of payments and land grants for your service in the military, and promises of other monetary rewards like a bulk bond or issuing of a debt certificate that the United States owed you money and for your service. And a lot of that actually did not come true, and a lot of people were veterans of the Revolutionary War actually got together later because they were not paid, and the new government reneged on the payment for their service in the military. So the war itself, basically, as all wars do, kind of seesaw back and forth. I'm not going to go into every battle. There were battles where Washington lost and had to retreat, and there were some that he won. And then as it went on back and forth, seesawing back and forth, and that just continued with the British gaining ground in the southern states later in the war. And that continued until our allies, we borrowed money from France and put them deeply in debt to finance our war, our Revolutionary War. But also France and Spain weighed in because they had a large navies, and they had already fought with the British on the seas. And France even provided soldiers on the ground. And that was the turning point of the Revolutionary War. But it was on that flank anyway, looking to the east to Britain. Britain now had to fight Spain and France, and also trying to keep ground war going in the United States of America. Well, it wasn't really United States of America yet. It was the colonies that were being fought over. So the war swung in favor of the rebels. In the we had had a bunch of ambassadors. I think John Jay, Benjamin Franklin, Adams were all founding fathers. They had already been over in England and France trying to create a peace treaty that would recognize the independence of America. So finally, in 1783, the Treaty of Paris was signed, and the Treaty of Paris not only recognized the sovereignty of the United States and set up the 13 colonies as the United States of America, but the treaty also granted new states, granted to the United States all the land all the way to the Mississippi River. And, of course, this was land that was reserved for the Native American tribes. And what that did, besides launching the greatest ethnic cleansing in the in North American, or actually, I don't know if it's the greatest in history, but it's right up there. And there was a policy of genocide pretty much put in place, and of aggression by the founding patriarchs. And there aren't too many estimates that I found. I mean, I know there are estimates of the number of Native American Indians that were murdered in that aggressive takeover of that land between the Appalachians and the Mississippi. But one thing we're sure of, it's probably in the millions. There are many more millions of Indians that were around before the landing of Columbus, I should say, or maybe the landing of our forefathers at Plymouth Rock and other areas around the New World, so-called New World. Anyway, most of those people were most of the Native Americans that were killed. There's much like it is in any war. 75 to 80% are all innocent women and children, And we see this still going on today. For some reason, it's perfectly all right to kill innocent people as long as you're fighting for democracy and freedom. I'm not sure how that works exactly. But there are many of the founding patriarchs were aware of this, like George Washington. Of course, he had been killing Indians before he became the father of our country. And that never stopped. And in fact, he was even in charge of sending the generals and the other officers to destroy basically the Iroquois nation, the Iroquois Confederacy in New York, even during the Revolutionary War. So he had a name. George Washington was known among Native American Indians as the Burner of Towns. And interestingly enough, one of the outcomes of the Revolutionary War was the fact that George Washington himself gained over 50,000 acres of prime land in the Ohio River Valley. Previously, this was land taken from the Indians by our new government. So you can see kind of the connections, especially in George Washington's case. Excuse me. Well, the I don't want to run out of material here. I mean, I could go on about different aspects, but the founding fathers already had their eyes on that land before the Declaration of Independence, before the Constitution, and were actively, aggressively, militarily moving into those territories while we fought for our independence. And we called – it's interesting because I remember looking back at my history books when I was a young man, and the whole expansion of the United States from the 13 colonies all the way to the Pacific Ocean was called Manifest Destiny. Manifest Destiny. What does that mean? Manifest Destiny. It's like destiny implies, oh, it was going to be. It had to be that way, right? We were meant to. It was meant by God for us to occupy and take over Indians' lands and slaughter thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the process, and war with many nations in the process of manifesting that destiny. Manifest destiny, interesting words. it's like it wasn't part of the policy, it wasn't part of the plan, but in actuality it was part of the plan from the beginning. And so we are descendants of these same pioneers, descendants of these same forefathers, the Europeans that came to settle in America. And I still go back to the Declaration of Independence and how we somehow legitimized all of this aggression and the death and destruction of war in the name of equality and in the name of unalienable rights. And yet not everybody had those rights. Yeah, it's like George Carlin says about the American dream. The Declaration of Independence was the beginning of the American dream. And like George Carlin says, well, you have to be asleep to believe it. And I think we're still asleep. I think we go through every day. Most Americans, like most farmers and the working people of all time, of all history, are busy working. And they get their news from certain places and they go, oh, yeah, that's interesting. And until it affects them directly, they don't respond. And many times they don't get to respond at all, or if they respond, they're crushed. Crushed by those same institutions that we hold to be sacred, like the military. Only we call them our troops. Well, in reality, our troops are not. Our troops are working for a military that's basically run by corporate interests and global interests. So not too much has changed. As things change, but they remain the same. So this is exactly the scenario we had during the Revolutionary War and the run-up to the Revolutionary War. Certain rich people's motivations and desires for more riches and power were extended through the people in the name of freedom and justice and inalienable rights, and where their power and their desires and their interests were served at the cost of the average person. There are many more of the common soldier was murdered than there were officers. And this was typical and has been typical because of the elitist nature, not only of the Pentagon, but also of the society behind them, the people, the war profiteers in America, even today, they're the ones that got rich. So when we think about so many things in the past, if we have an opportunity to, and we all have that opportunity, you can go online, you can research these things that I'm telling you for yourself. But the past that we're given in our classes in U.S. history, in schools, and what we hear from even authors that are considered Pulitzer Prize-winning authors, they're not necessarily the truth. Sometimes they're partial truths. And usually they're partial truths that serve us to make us feel better, to make us feel exceptional, when in reality we're not. We're still the same dupes we've always been, and we're still in the same position we've always been as the common person, the average person. And this is the way it's been for hundreds of years, and maybe probably thousands of years if we keep going back. But it's usually force, as Thomas Paine would say, the greatest thug wins, and he and his bandits control the wealth, and they control people. And this is the way it is. This is not only the way it is in our history. This is the way it is going back in the European history and other nations for thousands of years, probably since the creation of what we mistakenly call civilization. So I want to remind you again, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I do have one announcement to make real quick. I forgot to do this at the bottom of the hour. Let me do that. First of all, we're having a kind of a benefit show, and we're calling it the Far Northern Acoustic Showcase, and it's going to be held at the Gray Pine Farms in Oak Run. And right now they're looking for bands that want to participate. It's going to be kind of a long day of music and fun and dancing. And it's scheduled when? Let me see. Well, sometime in October, probably October 1st or somewhere in there. Anyway, that'll become – no, October 11th. I'm sorry. And it's going to be an all-day affair from 11 to 10 p.m. But if you're interested in participating, you can call Kathy at 530-275-3951. So any of you people out there that have a band that like to participate in this fundraiser for KKRN, that would be wonderful. So once again, call Kathy 530-275-3951. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun, and KKRN will be there. I'll probably be there tending the beer booth. That's my favorite. And I want to stay close to the beer. So If you can, if you're interested in that, and later we'll have more information about attending it when we have we get more things in place. But that's going to be our October fundraiser, and I want to thank all of you out there, by the way, that do support KKR and in more than one way. And a lot of you serve with your labor and not only donating on a monthly basis, but also helping out whenever we have an event like this October event. So I want to thank all of you, all of the people that donate, and all our underwriters. If you're a fan of the show and you hear some underwriting announcements, that's your chance to support again, because if you support our underwriters by going to their businesses, that supports the information that you hear, the great talk shows, and the great music you hear on KKRN. So I want to invite you all to go to kkrn.org and participate in that too. All right, that's my long, what is that? PSA, public service announcement, and call out to all of you out there to support what we do. Well, I did a lot of research for this show, and the more I researched and the more I read, the more I realized that we go through life thinking we know things. In reality, most of what we know is possibly and probably not true. And so I encourage all of you to do your own research. I encourage all of you to become critical thinkers, to question everything, because we just have to. Even in today's massive amount of commercial media, and maybe especially because of today's massive amounts of commercial media, we need to look other places. We need to look in I like truthout.org. TruthDig is another one that's wonderful. Information Clearinghouse, which is one that just puts all kinds of interesting articles. It's a collection of articles every day. And these websites are maybe a better source of information for you. In fact, almost assuredly, because we know from polls that people that don't listen to any commercial television news at all know more than the people that listen to Fox News. They know more facts about what's going on in the world and in their country than the people that listen to Fox News. That's a pretty stunning fact. And the implication, of course, is that you're not being told the truth. And there's so many areas where that's true. In fact, it's almost all areas, because deceit of the American people is important. It's important for the people that maintain power. And, you know, the promise of the American dream, that's important to keep that alive, too, because otherwise, why would we participate in some of the wars and some of the things that we do? We have, we've got about, 7 minutes, maybe less, 6 minutes. If you'd like to call in, I invite you to call in and just give me your opinion about what you're saying, what I'm saying, and what you think about the American Revolutionary War and our history. 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. Well, the as I said before, there was, or maybe I didn't, we ended the war with the Treaty of Paris. And the Treaty of Paris did two things, of course, recognized our sovereignty, and it also opened up all the area between the Mississippi River and the Appalachian Mountains, and not up into Canada and not south of Florida, but that's a huge amount of land. If you look at the size of it, it's probably, you know, at least double what the original 13 colonies were. And, of course, that opened up a land rush and abuse of the Native Americans who were promised that land by Britain. And you would think after the Revolution and all these great opportunities, things would be better for the new citizens of the United States of America that were operating under the Articles of the Confederacy. But in reality, not much changed. And why would you expect it to change? You had... elite military and elite colonial governments that were operating under the British Empire, and now they became independent of the British Empire, but they were still the same people operating in the same way that they knew, and which was control and taxation and the same things that the original colonists that were involved with the British were trying to overcome and were protesting against. And so let me read you this little excerpt from there's a historian, his name is Charles Beard, and he concluded in his book, the book's name is An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution. And according to Howard Zinn, who quoted part of Beard's book, but he also kind of made a synopsis of what Beard discovered. And according to Zinn, historian Charles Beard, by studying the economic backgrounds and political ideas of the 55 men who gathered in Pennsylvania in 1787 to draw up the Constitution, he found that a majority of them were lawyers by profession, that most of them were men of wealth in land, slaves, manufacturing, or shipping, and that half of them had money loaned out at interest, and that 40 of the 55 held government bonds, or according to the records of the Treasury Department. Thus, Beard found that most of the makers of the Constitution had some direct economic interest in establishing a strong federal government. The manufacturers needed protective tariffs. The money lenders wanted to stop the use of paper money to pay off debts. The land speculators wanted protection as they invaded Indian lands. Slave owners needed federal security against slave revolts and runaways. Bondholders wanted a government able to raise money by nationwide taxation to pay off their bonds. Well, what is end of quote? And what is so? What does this mean? Well, it means that the founders, and we haven't gotten to the writing of the Constitution yet, and that'll be the next show. But the founders were basically rich men who were adding to the evils that the British had. And, of course, they had one advantage. They were sitting right there. They're part of the 13 colonies, not far away. Oop, well, that's our music to end our show there. So I won't go on too much more with that. But so this comes to the juncture. The Revolutionary War has ended. Now we're looking at what happened after that and the Constitution, writing of the Constitution, why it was written and ratified. So... you've been listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling. My name is Doug Bennett. I have been your host for this installment of Truth About America, number 2, the American Revolutionary War. Next week, I'm going to try to have Paul Craig Roberts back on the show with me. We'll talk about Ukraine and regime change and revolution in the modern-day world. So tune in next Saturday, August 2nd, 9 a.m., to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. Next up on KKRN is Peace Talks Radio. Thanks for listening.